Today on Gaoithne Ochtú a Chéan, we hear from Andre Murphy. Living in Dublin and just 10 years old in 1981, she looks back on the national political impact of the hunger strike, her own memories of that time, and how the courage of the hunger strikers and their families continues to inspire her today.
The hunger strikes in Dublin were an entirely different experience to what they were north of the border. Mine was a very non-political family. There's no politics in it at all. And, you know, if I was aware at all about a conflict in the north, it was very much around IRA actions. In fact, I grew up with this idea that the Dublin Monaghan bombings had happened because of the IRA. And that they were responsible. And that was definitely not uncommon in Dublin at all. And then all of a sudden, this imagery, and that's what I remember most, imagery starting to kind of come onto the streets. And it wasn't really the media at all. It was that Bobby Sands' face started appearing on post boxes or lampposts, and posters started to go up. And then my birthday is in May, and I can remember Dublin having a lot of black flags in May. And it was actually a really nice month in terms of weather. And, you know, there were a lot of black flags, and that continued on into a summer where it was a beautiful summer, and we headed to Kerry that year. And Bobby Sands' face in particular, and all of these black flags, and the word H-block or smash H-block was absolutely everywhere. And this was an entirely different narrative to what kind of pervaded this idea that the IRA was responsible for trouble. This was different. This was a new political narrative that was about hunger strike, about resistance, about a hero, a completely different type of awareness. And I suppose I won't pretend that there wasn't still a fear factor around it being north of the border, or there wasn't some sense of, you know, this being pushed away a bit, but it was definitely much, much closer than, say, pre-1981. And there was a sense then of the north becoming political, because it was seemed like only a hair's breadth away that the Pope had visited and spoken about the men of violence. But then you had the bishop, you know, you had this sense of the Catholic Church suddenly having some sort of intervention around the hunger strikes, saying, no, there's something here that the British government are responsible for too. So, you know, there isn't just the men of violence, i.e. the IRA, there's also the British state are engaged in something that is awful. So it was an atmosphere, it was imagery, and it was an opening of something new into the dialogue. So I think that, you know, then the period goes, right? You see the period kind of end, and then something else happening where you hear of elections, you hear of Republicans being engaged in elections, and Sinn Féin start being involved in elections in the South. So Sinn Féin posters start going up. So in the 1970s, early 1980s, you would have seen Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Labour. That would have been it. After that, then Sinn Féin posters start going up, and that is so resonant of the hunger strikes. And you can see the link that's happening there. And as I get older, then I suppose my perception is changed, but framed by what happened with the hunger strikes. So in Dublin, on the days of the funerals, the shops closed. The shops only closed in Dublin half days on Wednesdays, Good Friday and Christmas Day. Other from that, the shops were open. Apart from those days when the hunger strikers were being buried, and our local shops closed. And it wasn't out of fear, it was out of respect. And the black flags were flown, and there was a real sense Bobby Sands is being buried today, Francis Hughes is being buried today. Names, an association with a struggle that would never, ever have happened pre-1981. Happened from then on. And it was said with, if people weren't even supporting it, they were respecting it. It was undoubtedly respect. And I can remember talking about, they even have MPs and they even have TDs. And there was a sense that this was really different. And there was a real sense that, you know, Fianna Fáil were being affected by it, because While my house wasn't political, my father would have had a Fianna Fáil family background. And I can remember him that summer driving from Dublin to Kerry and it being on, you know, country walls and up on mountains, smash H blocks, support the hunger strikers. And him saying, I don't know how Charlie is going to deal with that, speaking about Charlie Haughey. And, you know, I mean, I was 10, but I can remember those type of conversations happening in a non-political car, you know, where the only other sound was like the Fury Brothers singing Sweet 16. Those are the two memories I have of that time, talking about Bobby Sands and his impact on the wider political environment and Finbar Fury singing Sweet 16, you know, and it was real. It pervaded everything. So, and that was completely changing. It was no longer solely military and seen through the lens of military actions. Now the Northern conflict was seen through the lens of politics, and that was seismic. I think what you have to remember is that Section 31 had had a decade of influence on the body politic in the South. And Section 31 wasn't just about Sinn Féin representatives not getting onto the telly or onto the radio. It was about the entire Northern experience not being on the telly and the radio, except to say another person was killed. So, and except to frame it all through the prism of fear. And that was completely deliberate. And now you have this democratic vote electing, you know, two people from the belly of the beast, from the H blocks to Leinster House. And that changes the environment because you're seeing then a democratic support for those prisoners and their struggle, but also potentially for a Northern experience of oppression and a political way forward out of conflict. And that was entirely new. And that changes the entire framework. You know, from then on, you don't just have a Section 31-minded response to the Northern conflict. You see the beginning of discussions around Dublin being involved in the North, eventually leading to the Anglo-Irish Agreement, eventually setting the platforms for, you know, the dismantling of Section 31, the dismantling of the exclusion of Republicans from the body politic, eventually leading to a peace process. You know, it is hard to overstate the impact of Section 31 and the impact of the decision of the Southern establishment to disengage from the North. Partitionism was never as effective as it was from 1972 onwards. And, you know, 1981 begins the dismantling of that. And I think you can see, you know, we're still seeing the effects of it. And, you know, if we're going to say that it was anything other than a generational beginning, we'd be lying, because we can see the impact of Section 31 still, where partitionism is so entirely ingrained in the Southern state in a way that probably even in 1981 it wasn't, you know. But this begins the fight back. This begins the integration of the Northern experience as a national experience, not just a partitioned experience.
But
then once I start becoming politically engaged at the age of 16, 17, then the experience of the hunger strikes and the experience of engagement in politics on the island is completely framed by 1981. The political discussion, you know, when I start becoming involved in the discussions around politics, it's after the abstentionist debate. It's like only a few years later than I'm involved in that. So the abstentionist debate in Sinn Féin had a seismic impact on Republicans, obviously, because they were making a determined choice about the way politics would be done nationally on the island. But it also had a huge impact on the body politic in the South, informed by the Anglo-Irish Agreement, informed by the Southern response, where they saw a lot of things through the security prism rather than through a political prism. And me as a young activist, just coming to it all, trying to learn, trying to, you know, getting things wrong. Like, I can remember my one time being in a gathering of people and using the word maze instead of H blocks. And I did it once and that was it. You know, you learned a new language and you learned a respect for a struggle that had been experienced for over 20 years, but never once did you have to be taught or to learn a respect for what happened in the prisons in 1981. That was already there. That was ingrained inside, that somehow went beyond years, went beyond censorship, went beyond all of that. It was ingrained in you and you responded in a way that was almost visceral. And it reached right into your Irishness, reached right into what you want to be as an Irish person, which I think it is something that's really interesting. And, you know, you could kind of think about it. But what it did for us as young activists was it said to us that that sacrifice would never be matched, but it could never be let down. You had to respect the utter determination and dedication of the hunger strikers and make it worth it. And we did it through political means on a national level, you know, in a southern state that didn't want to hear about it, that wanted to continue to censor, that wanted to continue to isolate Republican politics and very effectively isolated Republican politics. And so what kept us going was, and I'll use the words of Sean Crowe, TD, it lit a fire inside you that was never extinguished. And that, what it didn't matter what age you were, it was there. And, you know, no matter how low and isolated and effective the anti-Republican agenda in the South was, and it was, it never matched that fire that was lit by the hunger strikes. Republicans in the South, unless they were a Republican family, a traditional Republican family, if you were a Republican activist in the South, you often had no contact with the rest of your family, because if you did, you were bringing contact from the Gardaí special branch, from constant surveillance through raids, things that were completely probably difficult for people to understand in Belfast because that was part of daily life. But in Dublin, it absolutely wasn't. So when I got involved in Republican politics, my details were taken and my flat was raided, which was grand. But they went and they raided my mother's house, a single parent without a politics in her head, and her friends. They went to her friend's house, all because I went to a few marches. And, you know, so I was absolutely not on my own in this. All of us in my friends group had no contact with our parents or very limited, reduced right down. So our family became the other members of Sinn Féin. And, you know, that was quite effective from the state's point of view, because if you were Republican, make you appear threatening when you were nothing of the kind, but they made you appear threatening, made you isolated. So it reduced the number of people who wanted to even touch Republican politics, and it reduced the number of people then who would become active in it. And it was very, very effective from all of that. And it's quite astonishing that despite all of those tactics, we were able to survive, and not only survive, but promote a peace process when the time came about, promote the idea that this was a national project and that there was a vision for a new Ireland, and that the public would still buy that. The public engaged in that as soon as the moment came along, despite every effort of the pro-British establishment in the South. For me, when I was around that age and I was looking at the ages of the hunger strikers, I can remember going, God, I used to think they were old men. They were kids. They were kids, and not only did they make this decision, they had already made so many hard decisions, already experienced the worst of what our conflict could throw up. And yet there they were, they kept going. And to be honest, I always felt a bit inadequate and that they were incredibly, incredibly special people. And as I grow older now, and my eldest son is coming 23, and I look at that and I go, wow. I think about them, but much more I think about their parents. I think about the extraordinary strength of those parents and the impact it must have had on them. And they did. They made a sacrifice that that no one should ever have to make, and no one will ever be able to pay back or make it worth it. And that will never, ever happen. All we can do is try our very, very best to make our country as good a place as it can be, you know. And, you know, so the qualities of the proclamation, you know, of cherishing all of the children equally, of saying that there will be equality for everybody, of saying that our country will be somewhere that we want to live in and be proud of in an equal way for everybody, and that nobody is excluded from that, whether you're British, Irish, or new to our island, you know, that is the only way we can pay tribute to it. I think 1980 and 1981 isn't just the story of the 10 men in the blocks. It's also the story of the campaigns that were outside, also the story of communities that came out despite horrendous military oppression to support the prisons campaigns. And I suppose when I look at it, I look at what the British state did during that time, turning on loyalism to try and execute the H Block and Armagh Committee, turning it off once people were on the streets, and bringing out British soldiers in the RUC to shoot dead women and children. You know, there were horrendous losses outside of the prisons as well. And that is part of the 1981 story. And for them, it's their 40th anniversary as well, you know. And I think that for us now, 40 years later, it's an opportunity for us to look at the entire complexion of that experience and to appreciate it in the whole and not just kind of silo any one of those experiences. And I think that is the benefit of time, the benefit of a peace process as well, that lets us do that. But it also is the benefit of what we've learned from commemorating other huge moments in Irish history, where we saw where there were gaps, say the experience of women or the experience of children, or, you know, all of those gaps that went before. We won't do it this time because we are recording the experience of the women who went to the prisons during those times, the children who were out in buggies wearing camogie helmets for the fear of plastic bullets. You know, there were real, you know, I think our history will be deeper and it will be more complex and will benefit as a result of that.